Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives to start the week. And, Jim, we start with certainly good news politically, maybe not so good news for the national security of the United States of America, but in years divisible by four, sometimes it's a blurry line, so it's a good martini today. And it's once again Hillary Clinton, and it's once again related to the latest dump of her emails from her private server while she was Secretary of State, one that's getting a lot of attention, in addition to another one where she scolds someone for using private email in conducting State Department business, is this exchange she had with Jake Sullivan, one of her top aides. It looks like it was on June 16th, 2011, and he's trying to get her some talking points. He says, you'll get talking points this evening. They're coming together. She says later, I didn't get the TPs yet, talking points. And then he's checking on it, and then he says, they say they've had issues sending secure facts. They're working on it. And then comes her email that's getting all the attention. If they can't, meaning get a secure fax, turn into non-paper with no identifying heading and send non-secure, which, of course, has a lot of people saying Hillary Clinton, who's been making such a big deal about her emails not having classified markings, is telling people not to send things that are classified with classified markings. So she was asked about this by John Dickerson on Face the Nation, and here's that exchange.
One of them is a back and forth between you and a staffer about a secure fax that won't come through. And you directed him to, quote, turn into non-paper with no identifying heading and send non-secure. Aren't you ordering him to violate the laws on handling classified material there?
No, not at all. And as the State Department said just this week, that did not happen. And it never would have happened. Because that's just not the way I treated classified information. Headings are not classification notices. And so oftentimes we're trying to get the best information we can. And obviously what I'm asking for is whatever can be transmitted, if it doesn't come through secure, to be transmitted on the unclassified system. So, no, there's nothing to that, like so much else that has been talked about in the last year.
Jim, in the voice of Alec Guinness, these are not the smoking guns you're looking for.
Yeah, you know. So you know how it looks like I totally just told him to send classified information by taking off the classified label? I totally didn't do that. What was implied in there is remove all the classified information. Totally. He understood what I meant by that. You know, we had our own little secret code language there. Pretty darning or damning evidence you can see there. Bob Woodward started making Watergate comparisons and just says, look, this reveals that she is someone who basically doesn't believe that the rules apply to her. The other thing which kind of jumped out, this kind of aligns with this on the kind of the Hillary front, Greg. So according to Fox News, the FBI isn't just looking at the insecure handling of classified information, which we certainly seem to have a smoking gun on this one. We now have this thing that they're looking at the intersection of Clinton Foundation work and State Department business that may have violated public corruption laws. Now, in previous editions of this podcast and over in the corner and all our own National Review, and I'm sure over on Radio America, we've talked about the number of favors done for Clinton Foundation donors while Hillary was at the State Department and the awards that just happened to go to Clinton Foundation donors and the policy decisions that just happened to go well for countries that had donated a lot of money to the Clinton Foundation and kept hiring Bill Clinton for these speaking fees that were just like $700,000 a pop. Look, this is really bad news for her. And the best case scenario for her is that the FBI reports everything. It's very hard to imagine they're going to look at this and say, nope, everything's fine. all looks cool. From that, you know, even if they do that, and the Department of Justice says, well, we're not going to prosecute this. You know, she's one of us. She's protected. Even if the Department of Justice jumps on that grenade, it's widely expected the FBI would release the report one way or another, and we would know what was going in there. And the FBI shark, so to speak, appear to be circling the Hillary Clinton campaign. Every Democrat seems to think, eh, this isn't going to amount to anything in the general election. And it just seems like something that it's very hard to imagine. This comes out with law enforcement and intelligence and national security professionals looking at everything she did and saying, yeah, no big deal here. She's cool. And, you know, the campaign moving on.
Yeah, and if there's trouble, it's just all those big right-wingers running the Justice Department.
Yes, you know. I suppose if, like, wanting to see the laws enforced is right-wing, then yeah, I guess they're right-wing.
On to the bad martini. And the actual story here isn't necessarily bad. There can be a debate about whether you think this is a good idea, but Jim has written on this issue recently, and there's an underlying problem with this, and that's the idea of the convention of the states. Obviously, folks want to amend the Constitution, perhaps tighten up some language because of the way they see the judiciary going rogue with respect to the Constitution, with the president going rogue with respect to the Constitution, and it's obviously very hard to get two-thirds through Congress and then three-quarters of the states. So what they want to do is get a convention of the states. I think you would still need the three-quarters of the states then to ratify whatever comes out of this convention. But you've got some more and more big-name people thinking this is a good idea, like Marco Rubio and now Texas Governor Greg Abbott. He gave a speech at the Texas Public Policy Foundation recently where he actually detailed 9 proposed constitutional amendments, according to the Dallas Morning News, that would unravel the federal government's decades-long power grab and restore authority over economic regulation and other matters to the states. Doesn't seem like a terrible idea. We'd love to have the federal government have less of a control. But, Jim, as you've written recently, to amend the Constitution in a smart way requires people to understand and appreciate what the Constitution actually says. And when you look at politicians on both sides of the aisle recently, it becomes less and less clear that people are actually interested in following the Constitution.
Yeah, and I say this as a big fan of Greg Abbott, a fan of Marco Rubio, who's called for this. Mark Levin, I guess, is the guy who's really been beating the drum for this. And he seems absolutely convinced that nothing bad could come out of this. The idea is that the Republican majorities in the state legislatures in these states could block any change to the Constitution, any amendment to the Constitution that we would see as bad to the cause of liberty and our perspective of the way America ought to be and things like that. I don't quite get why the blue state legislatures wouldn't be able to do the same for most of the proposals that we would put forth. And to me, again, I keep thinking this is putting the cart before the horse. I mean, when we find people who are flunking tests on what the basics of the Constitution are, like what freedom of speech is, well, you know, look, there's a very open there. You can find a lot of people in this country who don't believe the Second Amendment believes a right to bear arms. 4 of them are on the Supreme Court. All right. So we have this, you know, this very big difference. Like what's in the Bill of Rights is very much disputed right now. And as much as it would be and one of our contentions, certainly contentions of the NRA and certainly other folks who believe in this traditional viewpoint of the Bill of Rights, is that a lot of people just ignore it. You know, the president is not supposed to rewrite immigration policy on a whim through executive orders. Checks and balances are in there, and he just kind of ignores it. Now, thankfully, the judges have put an injunction on that. But when you have either a whole generation or a large swath of the population, however you want to classify it, not understanding the Constitution, ultimately not agreeing with what the founding fathers had set up, they don't really believe in freedom of speech. They certainly don't believe in a right to bear arms. You could argue the defenders of the NSA have a much different interpretation of the Fourth Amendment than we have in the past. That part of the real problem is that a good chunk of the country doesn't believe in what the Constitution says. And I don't really know that a constitutional convention is going to change that. And, you know, you say this and apparently Mark Levin screamed at me for like 30 minutes on the radio the other night. And I don't understand why. I guess the idea is that the process of holding this convention would make Americans more familiar with the Constitution. And it might, but I'd rather go into one of these, you know, convention of the states with a constitutionally educated public beforehand instead of afterhand, because I think it's much less likely to have bad outcomes that way.
Yeah, I think that is the critical point here. We're not against the idea of a convention of the states. Obviously, it's in the Constitution, which we like. All right, on to the crazy martini now, Jim. And we're not exactly fond of Hollywood and Hollywood values, but every once in a while, you find Hollywood figures that do things that are particularly odious that even surprise us, given Hollywood's liberal bent. You think of Jane Fonda cavorting with the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War. Nowadays, Sean Penn seems to be the guy that is just absolutely excited to hang out with the worst possible people. Remember, he was good friends with Hugo Chavez. So that gives you a little bit of an example of who he thinks are fun people to be with. Now, apparently, before El Chapo, the major fugitive drug kingpin, was arrested on Friday, turns out that El Chapo met with Sean Penn, and according to USA Today, Penn, the Oscar-winning movie star, political and humanitarian activist, rebel with many causes, writer and globetrotter, says he took a secret meeting last year in a Mexican jungle with Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. Turns out El Chapo means shorty, which sounds a lot cooler in Spanish than it does in English. But nonetheless, he did some interview that's now connected with Rolling Stone. They always find a way to find common cause with the worst possible people as well. And now, of course, Sean Penn is saying, oh, no, I'm not protecting or consorting with criminals. Turns out Guzman wanted a meeting because he wanted some Hollywood bigwig to make a movie about his lucrative life of drug dealing, which also includes mass murder, torture, and power grabbing in Mexico. I'm sure that part wouldn't necessarily be in the film. But if you're going to do a biopic of one of the worst people in the world, you might want to tip somebody else off.
So I'm looking forward to the movie, though, Greg. It's going to be called When Shorty Met Spicoli. So, yeah, I mean, here's the thing. It's not because I'm seeing some people say, well, look, you know, it's a fascinating portrait of evil. And but as a, you know, as a study of, you know, the human condition, it's fascinating, blah, blah, blah. Look, first of all, let's assume for the sake of argument, this is not some sort of elaborate setup in which Penn was helping authorities lead to this guy, right? I don't think there's any reason to think that's the case.
Right.
But if it is, boy, what you know, like who's the last guy you'd ever figure to be a narc would be Sean Penn, right?
Right.
Then, you know, he comes and he meets with this guy. And if this, remember, you know, Rolling Stone, which put the Boston bomber on the cover piece.
Right.
You know, if they had said, here's a portrait of the most evil man in Mexico, right? Or here's the man with more blood in his hands in the Western Hemisphere than anybody else. There's really very little of that. And you wonder if Sean Penn, who this allegedly brilliant intellectual actor, writer, you know, activist, does he even know this stuff? Or he just think, oh, he's a drug legalization activist. But by the way, he probably actually opposes it. So he probably
shocked
himself for being illegal.
Yes.
I don't see, you know, he's standing up against the man and the DEA or something like that. It's turned into this like twisted parody of anti-authoritarianism. Because if you think about it, if you asked Sean Penn, you know, do you believe in freedom, right? Do you believe in freedom from oppression? And do you believe in standing up against bullies who hurt innocent people? He'd probably say yes. And then he goes in and meets with this guy. I mean, can you think of anything more authoritarian than to live under the rule of a drug cartel kingpin? Right? If he doesn't like you, he will kill you. He doesn't need a reason. There's no courts. There's no checks and balances, right? I mean, this is entirely about exploiting other people and, you know, dispensing a poison north of the border and making as much money as you can and killing your rival. Like, this is the most anti-liberal thing in the entire world. And Sean Penn finds something kind of celebratory there. And it's kind of fun to watch. I get the feeling even the drug legalization crowd is kind of looking at this and saying, ugh. And then a good chunk of Hollywood is looking at Sean Penn and really wondering what you, because after you do that, God, why not interview al-Baghdadi, right?
Right. No, it's crazy. And you know how it's obvious that Sean Penn was not part of some elaborate sting operation?
Wow, Greg.
Because Matt Iglesias of Vox is convinced that he was, saying Sean Penn infiltrated a dangerous Mexican drug cartel, leading to the apprehension of a wanted killer, and everyone's criticizing his prose?
Oh, there you go. That's there you go. That pretty much explains that there. I'll give the last point to Ben Shapiro, who observed, boy, it takes a lot to make me sympathize with Madonna.
You mentioned Spicoli before. That's really probably the last role where he wasn't involved in major role anyway, where he wasn't involved in some sort of just sickening political activity. So it's probably the last role you can enjoy with a good conscience.
There's that. But apparently in this interview with El Chapo, you know, Sean Penn describes himself as a journalist. Greg, considering, look, the early part of Sean Penn's, where you and I are old enough to remember the 80s, Sean Penn built his career on punching out photojournalists, right? I mean,
yes.
He was the original anti-paparazzi, constantly getting in fights and destroying their cameras. And he was a maniac. And now he's a very different kind of maniac, but just kind of observing, like, no, I believe in telling the human condition, but get that camera out of my face.
Jim, crazy Monday. Let's make it even better on Tuesday.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.